You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Con.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, sir.
Good. Let me introduce us. I am Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Con Carroll, and you actually have a pretty deep connection to this podcast in a sense, because the Non-Zero Podcast evolved out of something called bloggingheads.tv, which some might say was ahead of its time. But in any event, we were in this game a long time ago, in 2005, in fact. And you were co-host of one of our first shows, which was called The Week in Blog. Blog. I later had a feature in the newsletter called The Week in Blob, actually. That evolved into the DMZ, which is now hosted by Bill Scheer and Matt Lewis. Assuming it's still going, they've taken quite the vacation since the election. I'm not sure that's still a thing. But in any event, were you the first? It was you and Bill Scheer at the very dawn
we kicked
of
it
that?
Off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, back when I was, I think we started when I was still with National Journalism, when I was with the hotline.
That's right.
With Chuck Todd, of all people.
That's right. That's right.
So that's how far back. That's before he even went to NBC. That was when he was still with the Atlantic Company and everything else.
And anything else you say by way of introduction these days? There must be something.
Oh, no. You know, commentary editor for Washington Examiner. I served 7 years for the communications director for Senator Mike Lee, and I've been a Bob Wright fan from before Blogging Heads existed. Read his Non-Zero book and was very impressed, and I've been following him since.
Oh, you're just trying to soften me up. But it's nice for you to say that anyway. So this is like a bold, experiment in podcasting in the following sense. So I discovered while communicating with you on Twitter via DM that you have a book coming out. I said, you know, love to have you on my podcast, but like, I am so swamped that I don't have time to read a book. I'm a slow reader. I always try to read at least, you know, the better part of a book before I have somebody on. And, you know, I am more slammed than I've ever been, partly because of the book I'm writing. And apparently a movable deadline associated with that. So, but then I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to the other extreme from conversancy with the book. I won't even look it up on Amazon. I mean, you told me, I honestly don't know the title of your book, Con. I'll level it. Now, you told me what it's about, and I'm sure you told me the title. But, so I know it's about, it's kind of a defense of the importance of the family, as I gather. I mean, you're a conservative. I mean, you know, I'm slightly nervous because you could wind up, if not getting me canceled, lowering the esteem in which I'm held by my progressive friends. Who knows what you're going to come out in favor of? I mean,
that is the goal, Bob.
If there's anybody who can do it, Con, I'm confident that you can. So, no, but really, this is genuinely interesting. Like, I don't have any idea what you're going to say. I'm going to be reacting in real time. I mean, I have a general sense for a conservative view of the family. And it may turn out that there's very little I disagree with. But why don't you start out by telling us, what is the name of your book and what's it about, Con?
Yeah, the name of the book is Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. And the 2-second elevator pitch is it's a history of marriage from the dawn of humanity to right now.
I've written things relevant to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured you'd be a good person to talk to.
And so what's the connection between the history and your view on what needs to be done here to bolster the family?
Sure. I think the best way is just to kind of talk about the genesis of the book and why I wrote it. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I was Senator Lee's communications director in the Senate for 7 years. And during that time, he became chairman of what's called the Joint Economic Committee, which is kind of a boring committee that issues reports on GDP, taxes, and other normal topics like that. But Senator Lee wanted to take it in another direction. He wanted to do something different. He wanted to explore the topic of social capital, which is something that, you know, because originally kind of developed by Harvard professor Robert Putnam in his famous book, Bowling Alone.
You know who apparently was the first person to use the term, not to interrupt, but another early blogging head is Glenn Lowry, I think.
Really?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a good connection. I'll have to use that to try to get on his show as well.
You should.
But anyways, yeah. So he wanted to kind of put numbers on it to kind of quantify what social capital was and, it, you know, kind of advanced study of the subject. So he assembled a staff to look into it. And, you know, they're putting together all of these reports. And as a conservative, I had always kind of known there was a body of literature showing that marriage was beneficial to husbands and wives and children's and the larger community. But I never knew how deep that literature was and how otherwise, you know, progressive liberal people, you know, really believed in it. Most prominently, Sarah McClanahan at Princeton, who is now since deceased recently, unfortunately. So as I was reading all these studies, I wanted to go back and read a fuller history of marriage as an institution. So, you know, I went on Amazon like any person would. And, you know, everything on the left, I think, kind of missed the stories for the trees. And there were some books that went on to like maybe the beginning of American history. But then on the right, and I just thought that they were kind of missing the overall narrative. But then on the right, everything was like super focused on gay marriage, which fine is an important topic. But like gay marriage is an issue that's been controversial for 5 seconds in the span of history. There's so much happened before that. So I started studying the subject, and the book I ended up writing was the book I wanted to first read. So it really kind of just starts out with how marriage evolved and through the years and how we got to today. The kind of overarching narrative is that human history can be divided into basically three sexual revolutions. The first sexual revolution is at the dawn of humanity. It's what really made us human. It's what separated us from our ape common ancestors with the chimpanzees. They were very promiscuous, had his own problems, and moving towards monogamy is what made us human. The second revolution was the transition from hunter-gatherers to sedentary agriculture. And with that, you had property, accumulation of wealth, power, and you have men, a few men, dominating other men and women. And that was polygamy. Polygamy became the dominant cultural norm really throughout the entire world. And then the third sexual revolution was the movement back toward monogamy that really only came with the spread of Christianity and the monogamous norms enforced by the Catholic Church. And then through both violent and peaceful means, that then became the norm around the world today. Still about 25% of the world lives in countries where polygamy is still the main cultural norm, but most of the world now lives in monogamous societies. And then unfortunately, we're in the process of a kind of a fourth sexual revolution today. If you looked at the first American census up through about 1960, 80% of American households were led by a married couple. That starts falling in the 70s. And now it's below 50% at 45%. So a lot of people don't realize just what a sea change we have in the decline of marriage as a cultural norm to deal with human sexuality and channeling human sexual desire.
Sorry, did you say most kids are reared by one or more people who are not married, or that most households with kids are?
All households. So it used to be of all households.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be single parents, that could be whatever. 80% were led by a married couple.
Okay.
That doesn't mean you have kids or not. That has nothing to do with kids.
Okay. And
today that numbers is below 50%, around 45%.
Okay, but So a lot of those are not kids being reared in these circumstances. That may not be the issue. It's just a lot of single people living alone.
Right. Right. Okay. So I mean the book, of course, does touch a lot on the harms to children from not having two parents. But the point of the book is that it also the men and women who otherwise would be married are also harmed, just because marriage is so beneficial to mostly men, but also women. But you know, from isolation to depression to substance abuse, these are all things which have skyrocketed in recent years, and those hardest hit are the unmarried.
And you're saying that if you compare kind of mental health and so on of men and women, married and unmarried, men get more out of marriage than women, although women get something out of marriage.
Yes, I mean, yes. So there are some great studies. I think the most predominant one is one that looks at nurses in particular, and it shows that women do benefit from marriage. You know, in that that includes, you know, incomes, everything else. But generally, the literature does show that that men do tend to benefit more from marriage than women do.
Mm-hmm. So you would like to bolster the institution both for the benefit of kids being reared under circumstances other than a couple with a true bond, in your view, and for the benefit of the adults,
right,
because even if you would say even if they don't have kids, you're better off married, or is it mainly because, I mean, there must be a literature on the extent to which the outcomes you've alluded to, mental health and substance abuse and so on, depend on very according to marriage per se versus single status, or according to like marriage with children versus the other two alternatives?
No, when you were talking about the benefits for the benefits of marriage to husbands and wives is unrelated to...
Is independent of whether they have kids.
Independent of whether they have kids, correct.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting. But by the way, just when you mentioned like the difference between us and chimps. So at that point, you're talking about biological evolution partly, right? Like...
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we it is true too. I mean, in general, in primates, the extent of sexual dimorphism between male and female, that is a difference in body size, correlates with the extent in recent evolutionary history of strictly speaking, of variation in the number of sexual partners among males. So in polygamy, you have high variation, because some males are not having much sex at all. Some are having a little. And it's true. If you look at chimps, the much more sexual dimorphism. And with almost all primates, except for gibbons and... And I think bonobos.
Tamarins, if you want to include monkeys.
Yeah. Of course, we are apes. With all due respect to ourselves, we are apes. Okay. And... you know, it's interesting because, I mean, I have, two adult daughters, and I'm curious as to the extent to which there's a correlation with ideology, because when I hear the reasons that, like, people of their generation are not getting married, some of them sound like progressive reasons. You know, it's like, well, with climate change, what's the point of having kids? I mean, you hear that a lot. Like the world of the future looks so dismal that I wouldn't want to bring kids into it. You really hear that a lot. I assume you've heard this. And is there an ideological correlation in terms of who is more likely to be married, say, if you look at people in their 20s or something?
No, there absolutely is. It's more pronounced the younger you get, you know. So the younger generations, the more progressive, right, the more liberal you are, especially among women, the least like you are to be married, and the more conservative you are, the more religious you are, the more likely you are to be married. And you see this, you know, you have daughters, but the differences are even starker among females.
You mean between ideologies? So right, conservative, right. So conservative females of that age are much more likely to be married than progressive females of that age.
Correct. And the differences are smaller, like in your generation and my generation, because mm-hmm. I'm younger than you, Bob.
And I didn't realize that. That's shocking. And the difference between, there is a difference between females and males that is pronounced within a given generation. I mean, wait, let me do the math. How pronounced could that be, right? If in a monogamous society, you wouldn't think there'd be a big asymmetry between.
Well, there can be,
because they can marry people of different ages. There can be those kinds of patterns, but go ahead.
There is. I mean, you generally see men are much more likely to want to get remarried after they either divorce or have widows. And so, especially when you look at like the percentages of people who are dating, if you are a woman of reproductive years and you want to be dating, you are dating. Whereas for males, it's not as correlated, but you want to be dating. Whereas uh-huh. Women get older and their interest just isn't there. Whereas the men's interest continues. So you do right. have a situation where you have older men are constantly in the market. The older a person is, the more successful they are, the more resources they are. So those men are generally out to compete younger men who are the ones that end up with fewer mates than their equally aged female counterparts. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess whether the interest is there depends in to some extent on what you're seeing the relationship as being largely for. Like I know of older couples that are having issues, and it isn't so much because neither wants to be in the relationship, but because like the man wants sex to play a larger role or something. That said, I also do think I can think of more women I know who are not involved and are, you know, a little older and like seem okay with it. They're not like,
And this shows up in the polling data. I go into Pew has a great poll a number of years ago, the headline was more Americans not interested in dating, but then when you drill down into it, it was very much younger men very interested. But if you're 50, 60 years old and you get divorced or your husband dies and you're female, you're just like, I'm done with that. And whereas if it's the other way around, if you're a man and you get divorced, you definitely want to get back into the dating pool.
So are the trend lines just continuing to go in one direction? I mean, if it's from your point of view, just getting worse and worse. Marriage falling? What's that?
You mean as far as marriage falling?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the short answer is no. So it actually, is different among different cohorts. So for the, more highly educated, more successful, marriage has actually kind of steadied out and actually kind of improved since the 80s, and the divorce rate has improved markedly since the 70s. The lack of marriage, the decline of marriage is really concentrated among those without college degrees and those without high school degrees. So that is where you have seen a continued decline that so far has not bottomed out. But there has been a stabilizing and even a recovery among the college educated.
Hmm. That's interesting. That's funny because that would seem to work against the ideological asymmetry you mentioned before. I mean, conservatives are less likely to have a college education, right? And yet, you'd said they're more likely to be married. Am I getting something wrong here?
No. So yes, if you're college educated, you're more likely to be a Democrat. Yes. But that's more true of more recent generations than later generations. Mm-hmm. This was right. a realignment that only happened, kind of more recently. And it is a cross current. But then when you look around among those who do have college educations, of that group, the more conservative you are, the more likely you are to be married. And the mm-hmm. more liberal you are, the less likely you are married. So there are still subgroups within that. But overall, yes, it still is that the more college educated are still more likely to get married than the not college educated, the uncredentialed.
Okay. Now, on the historical part, the kind of the introduction of monogamy, mm-hmm. In evolutionary psychology circles, where I once hung out, and that's kind of the context for my book, The Moral Animal, there was the idea that you would expect monogamy as an expression of a political system where there was relative equality among males. And broadly speaking, I mean, there is this correlation. In fact, a woman named Laura Betzig, who was an anthropologist, but was kind of in psych circles.
I love Dr. Betzig. I cite her in the book.
So the book, Despotism and Differential Reproduction?
Yeah.
So she showed, how's she doing? Have you been in contact with her?
She's alive, unlike...
is she still in Michigan?
The only interaction with her I had is I was tweeting just as I was reading her book, about how I can't believe she's not more cited and more respected. Uh-huh. And she liked that tweet. And that's about the end of our relationship there.
Yeah. Her book, I mean, she showed that historically there had been a correlation between, kind of degree of authoritarianism, almost, or centralization of power, despotism, and polygamy. And it stands to reason. I mean, one possible explanation is that, I mean, first of all, in societies where there are great asymmetries of power among men, wouldn't shock me if the men with a ton of power use that to try to monopolize, as they say in F-Psych, sexual resources, which is to say, women. And on the other, you can imagine the correlation working the other way too, which is to say, the causality, which is to say, if you got a highly polygamous system, you can have a lot of men who don't have any mate at all. They're not going to be happy. So you're going to need a strong kind of hand, a strong central rule, authoritarianism, to keep them in line. So it could work both ways. But go ahead.
No, you're 100% right. That's all in the book. I mean, I talk that mm-hmm. that's part of the reason why I talk about, in chapter three, that the move back to monogamy from polygamy was absolutely essential for democracy. But, to get back to your first point about kind of the creation of monogamy is that one of the main focuses of the book is that it's not that humans were around and all of a sudden decided to be monogamous and invent monogamy. Monogamy is what makes us human, okay? It has been around for as long as we have. When you look at hunter-gatherers, there's been no mobile hunter-gatherer tribe that's ever been found that was not monogamous. Now, you may have had, someone's husband dies and the brother then takes on his wife. But it was very, if you had any polygamy, it was very low level and nothing along the lines that you would see in an agriculture society. It's really not until you have sedentary living in with agriculture about 10,000 years ago that you really start to see polygamy as we understand it come in today. And not only was it just in a couple places, polygamy is not something, that weird that the Mormons used to do and Muslims still do. It was everywhere. The chapter in my book about this is the polygamous world order. It was just how humanity was from, 10,000 years ago up until, really just the past 200 years up until kind of the turning of 1900 was when the pendulum swung back towards to most of the humanity being monogamous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just as an asterisk, there are technically hunter-gatherer societies that live in environments that permit significant differences of kind of wealth, like the Northeast Coast Indians.
Right. When you look at those are very sedentary.
I mean, they're sedentary, yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, they actually travel seasonally, but I know what you mean. They have actual kind of houses. So,
exactly.
They have summer homes, kind of. But, anthropologists who have studied the reproductive rates among men and even what is the term for it's not itinerant for hunter-gatherer societies that move I'm it's escaping me but non-sedentary have found that there are differences in reproductive rate, but that's true in monogamous societies as well. Whether due to divorce and remarriage or due to just fooling around on the side. So you see some of that, but you're right that, the hunter-gatherer societies that existed during human evolution, there was not much difference in material wealth among people, including men. Yeah. And it's when you see that difference that you start seeing polygamy.
Yeah. And there was a very much egalitarian mindset to mm-hmm. hunter-gatherer mindsets. And so in chapter two, I do talk about in this transition, one of the first pieces of literature you ever see is out of Babylon. You see the Epic of Gilgamesh, okay? And so you have Gilgamesh, who is this beautiful, strong ruler, except he's going around and he's screwing everyone's wife. And the people cry out to the heavens, they ask for a savior, and they're delivered a primitive man, a man named Enkidu. And mm-hmm. Enkidu lives among the wild until he's seduced by a temple prostitute who at least teaches him to wear clothes and eat cooked food. But he's still living on the edge of the city. And so then this man comes into the city for a wedding. In town, and it describes to Enkidu that on the wedding night that the bride is going to have sex with Gilgamesh. And Enkidu is so outraged at this that he immediately goes into town and fights Gilgamesh, and there's this big brawl. Gilgamesh ends up winning, but he doesn't have sex with the bride. They say they go on to be friends, and then they go on the larger epic of Gilgamesh adventures. But the origin of the story is these people, you know, you can kind of see that just at the beginning here, they know that it's wrong that the rulers are able to monopolize women the way they are. And so they have this primitive man, which, you know, for me is kind of like their old hunter-gatherer selves, come on and deliver them from this oppressive polygamous state.
Mm-hmm. And so you credit the Catholic Church largely, or I guess what was the original Christian Church before the Reformation? It was, you would say, the whole Christian Church.
Right. Well, the Western, not the Eastern.
The Orthodox. So was Orthodox Christianity still countenancing polygamy after it was not accepted in Western Christendom?
Cousin marriage. So the big, we're skipping ahead a bit, but we can go ahead here. So the big difference between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Church, right, uh-huh, is that the Western Roman Empire collapsed. Okay. So right, you had Rome as its own power that could set its own rules and make bishops and everything else. That never happened in the East. Well, of course it did happen, but it didn't fall for 600 or so years later. So all during that time, you still have the Roman emperor that is telling the bishop in Constantinople what to do and who can be bishops and set the rules. And he was totally fine with cousin marriage because that's how, you know, large, strong clan-like families presumed wealth and power was through cousin marriage. But in the West...
So that was the route to polygamy, is that you'd be married? No, what do you mean by cousin marriage?
I mean monogamous cousin marriage, but I mean cousin marriage. So,
you'd marry a cousin,
right? An arranged marriage. So you have the maybe we should actually go back here. Okay,
let's go back.
The origins of monogamy are found in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, who were kind of monogamous, but not the way we think of monogamy today. It was a unilateral monogamy enforced on women. So if you were a Roman citizen or a Greek citizen, okay, and you were married to a woman, she could only have sex with you and couldn't have sex with anyone else, but you could have sex with her, and then you could have sex with a concubine, a mistress, a slave, a slave boy, whoever.
Isn't that the way polygamy always works? The female sexuality is restricted, right?
But this isn't polygamy. This is early form of monogamy.
Well, in other words, you weren't formally married. You were only formally married to one woman.
Yes, right. You're only formally married to a woman. And that was the only way you could produce legitimate offspring. So the Greeks were really the first to say, Solon, the great senator, was, you know, kind of behind this. And he decreed, passed a law saying that, you know, he was specifically targeting, because there had been a number of civil wars in Greece at the time, he was specifically trying to cut down the power of larger families and clans. And so the way he did that is he said, look, only the offspring of your legally married wife can become a citizen.
Okay.
Everyone else that you produce sexually, they're not slaves. Mm-hmm. Right? They're free, but they're not citizens. And so, of course, then there's a bundle of rights within citizenship that then limited what those families could do. So that was kind of the origin of monogamous marriage as we understand today. But it still took hundreds of years to evolve into what we know today.
Okay. So when did you get, I mean, it seems like the key development is that it is at least, nominally considered not good to be having sex. In other words, extramarital sex itself is normatively discouraged. And,
right,
and you know,
so that doesn't come until Christianity. That doesn't come until the church. It doesn't come until 1 Corinthians, when Paul says, you know, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. But likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And it's that second part, the granting of equal authority over the husband, that was truly revolutionary and changed the world.
And we know as a sociological fact that monogamy was the norm among Christians in ancient Rome?
You mean the
I mean, we're not just inferring it old, from one scriptural old, passage
you mean
like
the old
that.
Non, you mean the non-reciprocal monogamy or the Christian reciprocal monogamy?
Christian reciprocal. The monogamy as we think of it today.
So, yeah. So, I mean, Christianity starts to spread. It's not like Jesus is resurrected and a light switches and all of a sudden everyone's monogamous, right? That's not how it happened. You wrote the evolution of God. Christianity took, you know, hundreds of years to spread, right? And then even as it is spread, it still has to assert a certain number of policies that then started making that norm a reality, okay? And so Joseph Heinrich, in a paper that he's, you know, mentioned in two books now, Secret of Our Success and Weird, he identifies this marriage and family program that the Catholic Church implemented that did really create this new monogamous norm. And it doesn't really take hold into a lot of these places until, like, I think it's 1200. I have a quote in the book from Kevin Hurley that, like, kind of, I mean, this is all not guesswork, but, you know, you're guessing, you know, what, when it became the norm. But the marriage and family program was, one, a ban on polygamy; two, a ban on inheritance to illegitimate offspring; three, a ban on arranged marriages; and then four, a ban on cousin marriage, because cousin marriage was often a vehicle of arranged marriages. So that was like a line to make it say, you know, we don't know if a marriage is arranged, but we're just going to ban a cousin marriage, and that way that will take care of a lot of the arranged marriage problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it was those four policies that Heinrich shows. The longer the Catholic Church was able to enforce those rules in a locality, the more the people in that area are trusting of strangers, more open to other ideas, trusting other people, and they're less likely to be you know, open to authority and other types of family clan kind of organizations.
Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, the term drought disenior, or however you pronounce it?
I do not.
Well, I may be so badly mispronouncing it that you'd know it if you saw it in writing, but it's a ritual where that during the, at some point in the Middle Ages, the, like the lord of the manor, like if some serf or somebody gets married, there's some difference in the hierarchy here. And some serf gets married and the lord goes in and like does something like just, I don't know, steps over the bed that the new bride is sleeping in or something. But supposedly, as I understand it, there had been a time when the lord was entitled to have sex with her, maybe just like once at the beginning, maybe just, but then that evolved into a ritualized, a merely ritualized version of it, so that lords no longer had that degree of control and privilege and sexual privilege.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that, you know, cultural norms like that didn't exist, you know, in even Christianized Europe. But that was not sanctioned by the church, right? That would definitely be a practice that the church was pushing against and would be a reason why the masses would want to adopt Christianity as a protection against that kind of abuse by the nobility.
So by what time, like by what century would you say we can be confident that, or I guess you'd say it showed up in different places at different times, but...
Right. And, you know, it's guesswork, but there's one paper that looks at, you know, kind of the number of identified mistresses that English kings had over this and shows it declining.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just wondering if you think this was correlated with a growth in either material equality among males or political power among males, you know, political.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So as the power of the patriarchy, each family declines, as the power of the clan declines, you start to see a growth in different institutions, which are more civil society based, guilds, cities, universities. So this is when you have that first kind of civil society, that first kind of social capital being built across clan family lines. And that really is the key here, is that all of that, you know, authority and coordination of human activity used to happen within families who would then kind of war with each other, Whereas as those family power structures are broken down, then you have more of a bottom-up building of other institutions that rely on trust, mutuality, consent, and those type of democratic ideals.
Okay. Khan, as you know, at the point comes in the conversation when we go into what's called overtime.
Okay.
And at this point, the rest of the conversation is available to non-zero members, which is to say paid subscribers. And we encourage people to become members because, for one thing, we need to keep the operation going. So if people believe in the virtues of what we're trying to do here in the newsletter and the podcast and so on, please feel free to become a member. Failing that, just smash the like button or rate and review us or something. But anyway,
maybe now we can switch to policy prescriptions.
Yeah. We'll jump to the modern era and say whatever you want to most highlight about the book. But first, let's remind people of the title and just say anything. Take a minute to just give them, do the sales pitch.
So it's called Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying a Democracy. If you wanted a in-depth history of marriage from the dawn of humanity up until now, I think it's a great book to read. Also, if you want to understand the growing gender divide in the nation, driving partisan politics, also highly relevant to today. It's available at Amazon. You can always follow me at Con Carroll on Twitter, or X. X it's called.
Yes, it's called X. Now, you know, sadly, there are people who are so young that they may not understand what the title Sex and the Citizen is an allusion to.
Impossible.
When did that show go off the air? How long has it been? Sex and the City, right?
I think, around 2000 or so?
Oh, my God. That's scary. 24 years?
Yeah, it is scary.
And it was a relevant show because it was about singles in New York, basically.
Yes.
And not singles in their early 20s. I don't know how old Sarah Jessica Parker was.
Yeah, no, they're very clearly, professionally situated and comfortable. So, yeah, they're definitely not starving artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so people should buy it. They should follow you on Twitter, X. As some of us still say. And